think in the past several years, what we've done is we've had the finance commissioner present an overview of the governor's budget, and then we've had some discussion with Mr. Stinson, with Commissioner Stinson, as well as others relative to where the economy is going. Just because of schedules, we've kind of reversed that. But at the outset, we'd like to take up the confirmation hearing for Governor Pawlenty's nomination of Tom Hansen as Commissioner of Finance. So, Mr. Hansen, if you'd like to come up to the table and just indicate, obviously I think all of us know you, but just a couple of words about why you considered the appointment, accepted the appointment, what you bring to it, and whatever else you want to tell us about yourself.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for letting me come here today to talk about myself and my confirmation. It's not everyone that gets to appear before a Senate committee with your resume and talk about yourself. I am honored to have been chosen by Governor Pawlenty as his finance commissioner designate, pending your approval. I have had the opportunity to work with many of you over the last 4 years and prior to that in my work with the House. I was taking stock the other day, and I've done 3 biennial budgets that I've overseen from the governor's office in consultation with the commissioner of finance. I've done 2 supplemental budgets, and I've done 3 capital budgets in my time at the governor's office, and gotten involved in every detail of those, as well as other management issues at the Department of Finance. I have appreciated the public expressions of support. I think one of my strengths is I understand the state budget backwards and forwards, and I'm by nature, a creature of the legislature, a product of I've worked in Washington, I've worked at the House, and in my role in the governor's office, I've worked with you. I think I know what you, how to work with you, and how to come to an agreement on difficult things. The bonding bill the last couple of years have been primarily my efforts in negotiating, and I thought we did a lot of very good things. I look forward to working with each and every one of you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be available for questions.
Thank you. And I will point out that Mr. Hansen's resume is in the packet. Are there questions for Commissioner Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the resume.
Chairman Purcell, you don't?
I don't have a resume. Yes. I just have 3 sheets. Thanks. Not that I have to ask questions about it. I just don't see it.
Questions from committee members. Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I do have a question. This past week, the Senate passed a bill to put inflation into the expenditure side of the revenue forecasts. I'm just wondering if you have a position on, on that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold. I don't think as I look at how we put our budget recommendations together, I don't think we would have changed one penny whether this bill had passed or not. I think it's more of a public perception debate that we're talking about. If you say the $2.1 billion is a surplus, you're leaving people with the impression that somehow inflation is covered or isn't a factor. If you go the other way and you cover inflation, you leave people with the impression that that government, as some call it, autopilot, or that those programs automatically continue. The way we do it now and the way it was in the November forecast, we mentioned it. When we budgeted, we knew what we knew it was 1.8, 1.7 for CPI, and we left $1.1 billion in 10 and 11 to anticipating that inflation will carry forward. Just like we did when we budgeted 2 years ago, we left, and it was a bipartisan number, $737 million in the out biennium, which is now 08-09. So I don't think it either way. It wouldn't change how we budget. And generally, the more information you have in keeping track of inflation is a good thing.
Chair Bessel.
Mr. Chair, I sat through Commissioner Engeson's briefing of the press on the November forecast, and although she spent about an hour with Mr. Stinson putting all the qualifications there, the qualifiers, the cautionary notes saying this really is a $2 billion, it was clear that the Capitol Press Corps was honed in on the fact that there was a $2 billion surplus. And I don't know how if she could have been any more clear with it. Obviously, we can't control how the press reports it or what their perceptions. I'm just wondering if there's a better way we can approach it so that people will have a better understanding of whether we have a $2 billion surplus or whether we don't have one. How can we address that in a way that people can understand?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, I think that's a good point. I think having this debate, no matter how it ends up, serves to educate. But we, and I mean we, the governor and I, need to do a better job as well at talking about 2.1 being available for use. But remember, inflation carries forward, and it's a consistent message. You know, and sometimes we get over exuberant. I think the state of the state, you know, he talked about surplus a little more than I would have liked, but I didn't get to see the speech before he gave it. So I think I heard Peggy or the Commissioner Engeson and Dr. Stinson talk about it as well, and I thought it was fairly clear. But everybody still reported that 2.1 number. Maybe it's how the forecast actually, maybe I was thinking about on that front cover, which is what everybody seems to read. You have bold that inflation. We had it on the front page in November, but maybe it just needs to be highlighted a little more so people know.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I don't think it needs to be highlighted. I think it just needs to plain go away. I mean, why don't we be truthful with people? You know, we asked the counties and everybody to have these truth and taxation meetings, and, you know, their budgets and numbers have to kind of add up, and, you know, we don't do that. And, you know, and Senator Betzel's right. I mean, it leaves a perception to the public that we're awash with money, and actually we're on the brink of being in a deficit situation. And with all the needs that are starting to press upon the state with our population starting to get older, this is unsustainable. And unless we have a budget mechanism that is truthful and completely open, we're going to continue to run into these problems, because we get calls every day as elected people saying, hey, we want more money spent on education. I'm sorry, we don't have money to spend on education. My grandpa is getting kicked out of the nursing home because the reimbursement rate doesn't allow the facility to stay open. We don't have any, so we need more money in that area. We don't have the money to put to that area. I would hope that when that bill reaches the governor's desk that, he would just sign it into law. I mean, being, you know, the only state in the nation that does it this way is... it's madness.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hansen, when I look at your resume, it looks like most of your job experience has been in a political context. How will you operate as the new Commissioner of Finance, should we confirm you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, thank you for the question. When the governor asked me to be the Commissioner of Finance, and it was something I'd never asked him. I had thought of that as well. And as I thought through it, some of the things I strongly believe and worked with Peggy, Commissioner Engeson, for the last 3 years on making sure the Department of Finance is the umpire or referee so that the numbers, you know, we can, you and I can debate on what the numbers mean in higher ed. You know whether we should go this direction or that direction, but never question the doing of the numbers. I have retained all of the senior staff that Commissioner Engeson had. Jim Showalter is still the budget director. Lori Moe is still the commissioner that oversees the accounting and computer functions. Dr. Stinson is still there as our economist and his staff, and Peter Sausen, who does the debt management, is still there. So I have retained the entire staff, the senior staff, and all the staff. Haven't replaced anybody and plan to continue how Peggy and I did it the last 3 years.
Further questions from committee members?
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Pariso.
I move the ratification of Mr. Hansen as commissioner.
Okay. Sarah Pariso is moving. I think the exact language would be, whatever. Which I have in front of me, would be that Sarah Pariso moves that the committee recommend that the appointment of Tom Hansen to be commissioner of finance is confirmed. Would be the
thank you.
Correct language.
Thank you for the crib sheet.
I'm only reading that, Sarah Pariso.
Thank you for the crib sheet.
Further questions, discussion? Sarah Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've had the opportunity to work with Mr. Hansen on several different projects over the years, and I've always found him to be very respectful, very knowledgeable about the area of that we were talking about, and I feel that Senator Pariso's motion is in order. I think that he'll be a good commissioner and look forward to working with him in the future.
Thank you, Senator Murphy.
Further discussion or comments? If not, the Pariso motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Commissioner
thank
Hansen,
you
thank you.
Much.
Okay, now that we're past that, let's, not that this wasn't important, but on the discussion of the economy and the budget, Mr. Laufenberg. As Mr. Laufenberg, Dan Laufenberg is coming to the witness table. Mr. Laufenberg, welcome to the committee. One of the things that I've been able to do as, actually any of us could do it, but as chairman of this of the Finance Committee, is I've attended the as many meetings as I've been able to of the Council of Economic Advisors, which is the group that advises Dr. Stinson on the promulgation of the budget forecast. And it's an education for the handful of legislators who are there to listen to these individuals who are obviously the preeminent economists in Minnesota and in some cases nationally, have national reputations, to discuss where the state's going, how we fit into what's going on at a national level. And Mr. Laufenberg is somebody who I believe is, if not the, if you're not the senior person on the council, you're one of, what, the two or three or so?
I've been around a long time.
And has a reputation, as the agenda indicates, he's the chief economist for Ameriprise Financial, but also has a reputation nationally. And one of the things that has been mentioned is that, if you'll allow me, that whenever it was a couple of years ago, you were given the award by the Wall Street Journal as the most accurate predictor in the country, I think, which I guess is the economist variation of an all-star game or something of that sort. But it's obviously with the number of people around to have that kind of reputation, to have that person available to the state of Minnesota is something that has made a difference to us. So what we're hoping is to have some comments from yourself on where our economy is going, how you see things over the next year, 2 years, and give us you know, some indication of where you feel we ought to be going as a state.
Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here. I am Vice President and Chief Economist for Ameriprise Financial, but I'm also a member of the Minnesota Council of Economic Advisors. The comments that I make today are my own and not necessarily those of Ameriprise Financial. Let me start off by telling you where I think the U.S. economy is going here in the year that precedes us, and then discuss 2008 briefly. This year, I believe the U.S. economy is likely to perform reasonably well, not quite as well as it did last year. Last year, you would argue that the economy probably grew at a pace slightly better than trend. We think that in 2007, the economy is probably going to grow slightly less than trend. That is not a view unique to us. In fact, Global Insights, which is a service that the Minnesota Finance Department uses to help put together their forecast, believes somewhat similar to I that the economy is likely to slow a bit in 2007. And it's probably a slowdown that's necessary because if the economy continues to grow above trend with the unemployment rate as low as it is, You're likely to see some inflationary pressures continue to build, which I think would really derail the economy in the long run. So you, what you want to do is you want to allow the economy to hit a bit of a soft spot, allow some capacity to be freed up to give you that that pause that refreshes and then the economy can move on. This expansion, which began in 2001, is now in its sixth year. It's, by historical standards, very long. It is more difficult at this stage of the expansion to sustain it, and therefore policy decisions have to be very very careful, and I believe the Fed has done a reasonably good job of doing that. So our view is that the economy continues to expand. It's a little slower this year. We think the reacceleration that you're likely to see as a result of this pause or this slowdown manifests itself in the second half of this year and continues into 2008. So we do expect the economy to deliver probably better than trend rate of growth in 2008, so we're not too concerned about that. In this environment, we're likely to see inflation, although we don't expect it to accelerate dramatically, we do expect inflation to be somewhat sticky downward. We don't expect inflation to come down to the levels that we might have grown accustomed to. 1%, 2% inflation has been sort of the bogey, if you will, for the economy the last few years. We think inflation is probably going to be a bit above 2% for a longer period of time than most economists might suggest. And the reason we think it's going to stay above 2% is because we have really enjoyed 25 years almost of disinflation in the U.S. Inflation has come down to a level that is very low by historical standards. The best you can hope for is that inflation is sustained at this lower level, and what is likely to happen is that inflation probably over the next few years is probably going to start to trend higher again. So I think it's very important that that we keep that in mind. The reason we think inflation is moving higher, I believe that in the 1990s, and if you remember, the expansion in the 1990s was the longest expansion on record. One of the reasons that it was able to survive as long as it did is because inflation was really well-behaved in the latter part of that expansion. And the reason I think it was so well-behaved is because you experienced two shocks in the late 1990s that really allowed deflation or disinflation to continue. The first one was the Asian crisis in 97, which basically allowed the dollar to rally dramatically. It put the rest of the world on sale. It basically took all the inflationary pressures in the U.S. Out of play. It did the job for the Fed. And then in 98, you had the Russian default and the long-term capital management issues, and you had another rally in the dollar, and you had another bout of disinflation, deflation coming from the rest of the world. In the absence of something like that happening in the next year or so, I would argue that you're not going to get the benefit from disinflation or deflation from the rest of the world. If anything, with the growth rates that we're experiencing in China and India, and now some improvement in Europe, I would argue that prices are probably going to be going up and that you're probably going to see price pressures coming from those from the rest of the world rather than disinflation or deflation pressures. So the bottom line is that this economy, I think, can continue to grow. I think job growth will be reasonably good this year, not as good as last year. I think job growth will probably improve in 2008. So for the biennium, I believe the U.S. economy is most likely going to continue to expand. I think there is a recession out there. I can't tell you exactly when it might be. It's not this year, I don't believe, and I doubt it will be next year. But if I'm the next president of the United States, I'm probably going to have to deal with a recession in my first term. And if I'm that president, I'd rather have it early rather than later. So if I'm the next president, I want it in 2009, not 2011. Because if you have a recession in 2009, the economy will improve in time for you to get reelected in 2012. So that's sort of where we are in the U.S. The Minnesota economy, there is no reason to believe that the Minnesota economy shouldn't perform roughly in line with the U.S. economy. There are some indications here in the very near term that maybe we might not be performing quite up to Minnesota, to the U.S., maybe falling a bit short. But given the diversity of our economy, we probably should deliver results that are very similar to what you should get in the for the rest of the rest of the country, or as the country as a whole. So there is no reason to think that we shouldn't be able to do that. That has been typically the case. We've been either slightly above or slightly below, but on average over a long period of time, we tend to really reflect what the rest of the what the overall economy is doing in our economy. And again, I think it's a compliment to the fact that our economy tends to be extremely diversified relative to a lot of other economies, local economies, state economies around the country.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Loeffenberg. Let me ask a couple of questions. You talked about a recession on the not far horizon, but not immediate horizon. For our purposes, as we budget for the 08-09 budget, so a budget that will, where the biennium ends on June 30th, 2009, could you foresee the possibility that in that last quarter of the biennium that we would find ourselves in some kind of a shortfall as we come back into the 2009 session?
Yes, at the earliest. I think the recession, if we are going to have a the recession that we're going to have is the earliest that it could occur is 2009. So, yes, that's always a risk. That's rather far out to make a very precise forecast. You have to remember that the confidence level around that particular call is very small. So I don't have a lot of confidence in making that call, but I think that's something that we will have to deal with sometime in that first term of the next president.
And at least relative to that, would you anticipate, and obviously the 2004-05 budget was put together based upon a $4 billion deficit, and without getting into all the causes, some of which came from the legislature and the governor, the 2001 tax bill obviously was underfunded and I would assume had nothing to do with the economy. But every state was experiencing a significant swing downward in the aftermath of the 1990s. Do you see any kind of a roller coaster like that when you talk about a 2009-2010 recession?
Yes, in 2009. If you have a recession in 2009, chances are it's going to be a lot more severe than the previous recession that we experienced. In 2001, it was the mildest recession on record. It's hard for people to believe that given what the stock market did, but in fact, it was the mildest recession on record. To give you some comparison, historical comparison, in 73 to 75, we had one of the most severe recessions on record. And the S&P 500 dropped 43% from peak to trough. In 2001, we had the mildest recession on record, and the S&P 500 dropped 43% from peak to trough. So it felt a lot like a really severe recession if you were just looking at financial markets, stock market in particular, but it was actually quite mild. The next recession is likely to be more severe than the last one. The reason the next recession is likely to be more severe is because consumers really didn't participate in the 2001 recession. The last time consumers participated in a recession was 1991. That was more severe than 2001, and I would argue that the next one is going to be more severe than 2001 because consumers are probably going to participate. Now, the reason consumers are going to participate isn't because they have too much debt or that they that they're borrowing too much money or that they aren't saving enough. The reason they're going to participate is because of what we mentioned earlier. We think that inflation risks are back. Inflation is here to stay, and the one thing that causes consumers to retrench, the one thing that really causes consumers to go into a recession is if prices are going up faster than wages. Even if you have a job, you lose purchasing power. That's the time that really hurts consumers because it's not the fact that you lose a job. I mean, yes, you will lose a job, but you lose a job because somebody stopped spending. So why did consumers stop spending in the first place? Because they lost purchasing power. How do you lose purchasing power? You lose purchasing power because prices go up faster than wages. You didn't have that in 2001. You had business spending that really drove that recession. Consumers really weren't in a recession in 2001. Consumers stopped spending for 2 weeks after 9/11, but consumers really were still spending. They were just spending their money in different ways. So we're We think that the next recession is going to be more severe. It is going to be more of a consumer-led recession. It's going to be more of a sort of a traditional recession in the sense that inflation is probably going to be a good precursor of that event. The Fed will do whatever it has to do to keep things under control, but I would argue that the Fed, with its some of the policies that it's implemented over the last few years, may have already helped set that up as a likely event. And plus, the Fed's not going to get the benefit that it got in the late 90s from some kind of international financial crisis, I don't believe. If it does, then obviously this isn't going to happen, which is why it's difficult to say anything with a lot of conviction about what might happen in 2009, because if we do have some international crisis that allows the dollar to rally dramatically and allows our current account deficit to widen even more, then this thing can be sustained for a while longer, but not forever.
And your comment leads me to another question in terms of if there's anything that could impact on that in any significant way relative to the world economy, whether it be China taking up financial space or anything on the horizon that hasn't been happening right now.
Yes, one of the reasons why, if the U.S. economy goes into a recession, then there's a very good chance that you're going to have a global recession because we still are the big player in the global economy. China's economy probably will suffer somewhat. The key to China will be whether or not, and India, will be whether or not they develop their own internal economies and not rely just on exports. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. For example, if China is in fact building a huge middle class, and this middle class is starting to demand goods and services domestically, then they will be less dependent on exporting goods to us for their growth. And so they can grow, which means that then in turn there will be demand for goods that we produce, which means that we can maybe soften the blow from the recession that we have internally. So, again, it's not the most severe recession that I have in the forecast. It's just a recession that's likely to be more severe than the one that we just had in 2001. So, yes, the rest of the world can help us out, can minimize some of the pain, but they're not going to prevent it from happening.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Laufenberg, could you encapsulate some advice for lawmakers in the interim? Is there any specific advice you could encapsulate that we could all recall?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think it's really very important that we be prepared for the next recession. And the Council of Economic Advisors for years has recommended that we have a fund, a reserve fund set up to help us through those more difficult times. And as a member of that council, I would recommend that that be the case again. Now, you can debate on how big that reserve fund should be. The council has always recommended 5% of the biennial spending, but that's, again, there's no magic with 5%, as Dr. Stenson would tell you. But that seems that there is some evidence to suggest that that's sort of what we would have needed to get us through some of the earlier periods where we had some budget issues because of an economic downturn.
Thank you.
Senator Bessel.
Thank you. The November forecast talked about a significant drop in housing construction. How do you see that trend?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes. Housing has been a very significant drag on the economy, especially in the last half of 2006, and probably going to continue again at least into the first quarter of 2007. But we expect housing to stabilize this year. We think the worst of the housing may be behind us. We think that housing starts probably are going to level off around 1.5 million units, which I think is the same number that Global Insights has in their particular forecast. We also believe that that sales are going to level off as well, maybe start to improve a bit. But the one thing that is not finished yet, the one adjustment that still is not complete, is pricing. I believe that house prices will continue to move lower. The lower house prices will make consumers feel less wealthy. It will be the one thing that will probably cause consumer spending to slow as much as I anticipate it will in the first half of this year, which is why we really have the slowdown. The key to our slowdown forecast for 2007 is that consumer spending slows from the pace that we saw in 2006. We think that is temporary. Once housing does start to show some signs of stabilizing, price adjustments will be complete, and consumers will come back. You think about it, there are a lot of people that were trying to sell their house that weren't able to sell the house at the price they wanted to, so they took their house off the market. If they get wind that the housing market is starting to improve again, that sales are picking up, then people that couldn't sell their house a few months ago will bring their house back on the market, try to sell it, and they may find out that they still can't sell it at the price they thought they wanted to, and they're going to have to make some adjustments if they're trying to sell. So we do anticipate that to have sort of an adverse effect on consumers' spending behavior. We think housing has been a big part. The upward movement in housing, the boom in the housing sector, housing prices moving up have really helped consumers spend more than their income would allow them to. And that when this corrects, and we think that correction is underway, this will cause consumers to spend less of their income. They're still going to have good income growth, it's just that they're going to be spending a smaller portion of their income as a result. It's called the negative wealth effect in this case. It was positive before. Now it's going to work into a negative effect. It's not enough to cause a recession. It's not enough to cause consumer spending to decline. It just means that consumer spending isn't going to be as robust as it had been.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Different question. It's been my understanding that because Minnesota does not have a strong military presence, there aren't any major active duty installations here, we've been less affected by the military spending or cuts. But the national economy is affected. Is the war in Iraq affecting the national economy to the extent that it may affect the Minnesota economy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the war in Iraq really isn't having much of an impact on the overall economy. Now, that's from an economist's point of view, so it sounds rather callous. But the point is that the actual expenditures probably aren't having much of an effect. The effect is very indirect. The effect is that you're probably going to have a larger federal budget deficit than you would have otherwise because you're going to have more defense spending. So larger federal budget deficits mean that the real rate of interest is probably going to be higher than it would be otherwise, which means that it's more expensive for you to make the investments you need to produce the goods and services for future generations. So what the war in Iraq is doing is it probably is forcing our budget deficits to be larger than they would be otherwise, which means that we're basically denying our grandchildren, I have two with a third on the way, of the living standard that they would have enjoyed otherwise. I've had this conversation with my 7-year-old grandson, and he understands. So my message is you tell them when they're 7, you don't wait until they're
elected to the
55.
State Senate. That's what he's trying to say.
Thank you.
But I don't know if it has a huge direct effect. What basically has happened, I think, is that the peace dividend that we were able to reap in the early 90s with the end of the Cold War is now gone. We're basically spending it again. And it probably would have been defense spending probably would have increased in any event. It's just a question of how you spend it.
Other questions for Mr. Laufenberg? Okay. Well, thank you very much for spending the time with us. This is
thank you very much.
This is helpful again to get a perspective from the consul, somebody at your level to just kind of give us an overall view. Often, we get caught up in the minutia of this place without trying to focus on having the opportunity to focus on what's coming down the road in a much larger sense. So appreciate your helping with that. So thank you for being here.
Much.
And to continue that overall view, the next person on the agenda is Jay Kudrowski. Mr. Kudrowski is to discuss with us the an overall picture of the state budget, you know, pitfalls, problems, things we can do. And as members know, Ms. Gradowski was the Commissioner of Finance during Governor Perpich's administration. More recently has been a Senior Vice President at Wells Fargo, now is a Senior Fellow at the University. And some people around the table remember when Mr. Gradowski led Edina to, was it two or three state championships, basketball championships?
I was involved in two of them.
Okay. Two state basketball championships. So, Mr. Gradowski, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to be here this morning. Let me try to broaden out the perspective as the chairman suggested. It was 1973 when I began to work for the state Senate, so I've been around some of these issues back since 1973. And I think that perspective is useful as you look at particularly the upcoming biennium. Minnesota's obviously had deficits and surpluses. 2003, you were here, many of you were here, for the deficit of $4.5 billion. And this November's forecast suggested we had a surplus of $2.2 billion. Quizzical how in 4 years we can go from $4.5 billion in deficit to $2.5 billion in surplus. But that, in essence, is the Minnesota revenue system. And that system has done this. This isn't the first time we've had deficits to surpluses. In fact, you can go back and see there are really three distinct time periods, essentially 9 to 10 years apart, where this has become the norm. I first came to the Department of Finance in 1983. It was after Governor Cui had unfortunately had the problems with the recession of 1981-82. They had a deficit at that point. I came in with Governor Perpich. We were still forecasting a deficit. By the time I left state government in 1987, we had a surplus. The classic recession and then recovery. The difficulty, and then again, the same thing occurred in 1991. At that point, it was the last of the Perpich years and the beginning years of Governor Arne Carlson. And then we had the same thing occur in 2000, 2001, when we had the problems then of the first we had the surpluses and the Jesse rebate checks. And then a couple years later, we had a $4.5 billion deficit. So I continue to call this Minnesota's fiscal roller coaster because that's, in essence, what will occur again going forward given the nature of our revenue system. So being old enough now, I guess, to be able to teach and offer some advice, my suggestion is that Minnesota fundamentally needs to change its revenue system. We have a very volatile system, one that's based primarily on a very volatile income tax that Minnesota underutilizes its sales tax in comparison to other states across the nation. And as a result, we have a more volatile revenue system than most, if not all, of the states in the country. So the old saying goes, when the country gets a cold with economic times, Minnesota gets pneumonia. And it doesn't have to be that way. The 1985 Tax Study Commission really went through this in some detail and made a number of recommendations. But the essential recommendation is that we need to balance out our revenues to a far greater extent at the state level and then also with the property tax at the local level such that you'd get a much more even distribution between income taxes, sales taxes, and property taxes in order to smooth out what will happen in the economy from the roller coaster effect we have today to more of a hilly highway going through some parts of, say, southern Minnesota. Otherwise, it's going to be possibly within this term, your term, another 3.5 years, 4 years, that we will see again a recession that will again bring us into a deficit situation that again will cause our local officials, our state officials, our county officials, our school officials, to be scrambling around dealing with a crisis when what they should be doing is trying to figure out better how to spend dollars more effectively within their units of government. So this pattern, this roller coaster pattern, I believe, has dramatically hurt the ability of Minnesota government to plan for the future, to develop more systematically, to make the progress that it could be making if we had that situation. With that, let me go on. I'd be happy to respond to questions and comments because I know it's some controversy. The governor and the legislature haven't been able to do anything about it for the last 30 years, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. And this year is actually a wonderful year to do that because you have some dollars to help with the transition. Second point I wanted to make today, interestingly, will be in support of some parts of the governor's budget. Some who know me think that that is an interesting juxtaposition. But old finance commissioners kind of stay together on key aspects. And one of the key aspects is trying to manage the state budget in as rational and as a planned way as possible. And the governor in this budget did a very good job of understanding that the surplus is actually only $1 billion, and that $1 billion is really only one-time money, and that you can only spend that $1 billion once, and you aren't going to have it to spend in the 2010-2011 biennium. And I think you're going to have a lot of groups coming before you that are going to ask you to spend dollars that will be ongoing. And frankly, you won't be able to balance the budget in 2010-2011 if you do that. So the governor's budget that he presented was, in fact, balanced in the 2010-2011 biennium. I think that's a great test. The 2020 caucus has recommended that as a test for the decision-making in this legislative session, that when you get all done with the budget, that, in fact, you're able to project including inflation, expenditure inflation, in the 2010-2011 biennium, that budget would as well be balanced. And I commend the governor for having done that. The second thing that the governor did that I think is really positive, and that's if you're not going to solve the basic underlying problem of our volatile revenue system, then you simply have to keep adding to the budget reserve if you want to have any kind of ability to respond in a thoughtful way to the next budget crisis. The difficulty, though, is that statistically, I think it was Governor Carlson's administration that put together a report about the economic forecasts of the state. And what they found was that the error rate of the forecast was plus or minus 10%. Now, that's a frightening statistic. Because it means that on a $30 billion-plus budget that you're going to be off plus or minus $3 billion in the forecast. That's the error range. So when we talk about a budget reserve of $600 million or $700 million, you understand that that really doesn't do very much for you given the kind of problem you're going to experience. And just go back to 2003, what would a $600 or $700 million budget reserve do against a $4.5 billion deficit? So the number that you really need to be looking at if you want to kind of ignore the revenue problem, the revenue volatility, and try to solve it through a budget reserve, you're talking about over $3 billion budget reserve. And my experience suggests that Minnesota citizens, well, clearly elected officials will demagogue how large the budget reserve is at some point and force the legislature to spend down some of the budget reserve, clearly if it started approaching a $3 billion level, even though we know it's going to be necessary. So that's problematic. Another aspect of this is that there is an alternative way of looking at the budget reserve. The governor has started down that path saying any additional dollars coming in excess should go into the budget reserve, and you build that to a 5% on an annual basis. There was another approach that was used for a two-year period in the late 80s, and that was to put in place a trigger tax. In 1985, the Perpich administration led the legislature to reduce the income tax. But as part of the provision, it said if the state heads into deficit, that tax decrease will, in fact, be allowed to rise back to its prior level to raise the revenue necessary to offset the deficit. That provision only lasted for 2 years because, in fact, the economy continued well. People said, well, we've solved this problem, and it's never going to happen again. And they took the provision off, and, of course, then 1991 it occurred again, and 2001, 2002 it occurred again. So something like a trigger tax is a way to have in place legislatively something that helps you offset that coming deficit without the problem of having the budget reserve be so large that it can't be sustained by citizen support. The last item, I guess, would be the item where I continue to differ with the governor's office fairly, or the governor fairly significantly, and that's on this question of expenditure inflation. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to applaud your committee and the Senate for having the wisdom to understand that if we're going to have inflation on the revenue side of a forecast, we need to have expenditure inflation on the expenditure side of the equation. Again, just look at all the headlines that talked about this $2.2 billion surplus when, in fact, the surplus was really only $1 billion. And you know that now that you're going to have to spend it. The governor's budget, in essence, shows that because he spent a billion of the $2.2 billion for the inflationary increases in the budget. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to stop, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Mr. Kudrowski, I can appreciate that what you present to us is not, pick one versus the other, but and this is the Finance Committee, not the Tax Committee. But on the question of, say, the trigger tax as a guard against deficits, is that as important as making a more of an overall attempt, maybe this is a leading question, to do something with the tax structure itself? I mean, you talked about the volatility of the income tax versus the stability of the sales tax. Does that suggest that the best thing the legislature could do would be to do something like impose sales tax on clothing and services, or one versus the other?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, let me be very clear that my first recommendation is that the state fix the revenue system. We've had 30 years of this torture. You've had to agonize through deficits. You get the joy of surpluses, but then you realize that everybody thinks you've got more money than you have, or people think you've got ongoing money when you have one-time-only money. This is not the way to run a state financial system. And other states have, frankly, found the wisdom of it. I can refer you to a couple of great articles that have been written recently about this very topic. Other states are dealing with the very same thing. And to that point, I think you need to start thinking about what's going to be happening with the income tax going forward and what's happening to the sales tax. Recent estimates say there's $7 to $10 billion in sales tax receipts that the states are not getting as a result of the Internet and sales tax-free activity on the Internet. So you've got a problem with how significant the sales tax is going to be. And then if you start thinking about the income tax and the baby boomers, I'm 56 years old. I'm kind of in the middle of the baby boomers. When I get to be 65, 70, I'll probably retire. At that point, you're going to have a hard time taxing me because I won't have income. I probably won't be consuming much, but I'll have lots of assets that I'm living off of, and it'll only be to the extent that I cash in on those, either in the forms of taking the interest and dividends you'll be able to tax, but it'll only be in the case that I sell something that you'd be able to get some capital gains revenue from somebody like me. And there's going to be a lot of Minnesotans in that situation that they're going to be living off of their retirement dollars, and they're not going to have the income, and the income tax isn't going to be as robust as well. So in addition to looking at the volatility question, I also think you have to look at modernizing our tax system for the future. A lot of that discussion gets back to relying more on a consumption tax rather than a pure income tax. Now, there's one other aspect of this that I have to raise, and that's the question of progressivity. I believe in a progressive tax system, but simply putting a sales tax on clothing and personal services does not necessarily mean the whole tax system has to be more regressive. You could, in fact, use a credit on the income tax at some level for those people that really have trouble affording that sales tax increase as a way of keeping the progressivity in the system. So you can continue to have a progressive system, but you'd have one with less volatility if you move more to the sales tax and away from the income tax. I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chairman. So before we do anything about reserves, et cetera, my clear preference would be, and I'd be happy to work with you and clearly the tax committee on ways to accomplish that.
You mentioned literature. Is there any literature that explicitly goes through that on a state-by-state basis?
Yes.
I've seen intimations of that, but not any detailed description of, you know, Arkansas has this kind of tax structure and it results in this kind of deficit versus surplus.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm actually this semester teaching state and local public finance at the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. I noticed at least one of my students here today in the audience. If you come to my class this afternoon, we're going to actually be covering deficits and surpluses across all of the states in the United States. And Thursday, we're going to be covering revenue systems. And there is data available on all the revenue systems. There isn't a great article yet that's been written about specifically which state is most volatile and why, but you can easily look at the 50-state data and come to those conclusions fairly rapidly, and that's why I say we have one of the most volatile because of the structure. And again, what happens, you can look at 2003 across the country and look at each state's deficit a percent of their budget, because just about every state had a deficit in 2003 because of the recession. So it's not like we'll avoid them. It's just we won't get pneumonia. We'll get the cold that everybody else gets.
Okay. And let me ask, to get back to this committee, relative to the roughly $1 billion that's been projected as one-time surplus monies, obviously needs the state come into play, politics of the legislature come into play. If you were running the show, would you simply take the billion and put it into the reserve or a significant part of that? Would you also consider buying back shifts that are still out there?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have one of the most difficult problems that a recent legislature has had, because the facts are so clear that you have one-time money. And everybody's going to want you to spend it as ongoing money. Your alternatives are either to raise additional revenue so you have ongoing money, or say no. The governor, I have a little bit of difficulty with. While he technically put money in the second year is one-time only money, I think there's going to be a lot of expectations, for instance, when you give it to K-12 schools or to higher education in the second year, that they're going to expect to get that in 2010, and yet technically they won't, and it won't be in any forecast, and that's a major problem. So you have this one-time money. A clever way of hiding the money, disguising the money, keeping yourself from being demagogued on the size of the budget reserve is to buy back shifts. The shifts are they're basically bad public policy, but they're very convenient. And when I was commissioner, we used one as well. So I've got the same problem, I guess, as we all have. So, but if you were to buy them back now with that money, it would, in essence, be building the budget reserve and your ability to respond to future budget crises if we continued the revenue system as we had it. Another approach clearly to the one-time money is to spend it in ways that truly are going to be developing our economic future. I do work for the University of Minnesota, so understand that when I suggest that the discussions I've had with our senior vice president for the medical services, when he talks about investing in a research facility, using some of the $1 billion to invest in a research facility, that would pay huge dividends for the state going forward, and it truly would be one-time money. So there are ways to spend that kind of money. Another example would be if we perceive that there was a need for computers in all the classrooms of the state, and I don't even know if there are or not, but that's clearly a one-time expenditure that you get a benefit down the road, which is very useful. So you can look at spending money in a very thoughtful way to invest in Minnesota's future.
Well, I think the legislature is going to be careful with the one-time money as represented by the money collected through the end of this biennium, and we'll be very careful about utilizing that money for ongoing purposes, you know, putting that money into the school aids bill or in the formula. So my question is more directed toward what you're describing as one-time usages as opposed to, in effect, reserve accounts. You know, the same as with the bonding bill, it would be very easy for us to come up with a lot of one-time uses, I mean explicitly one-time uses for that money. And yes. So what's the division if there is one? And of course, you know, as you know from your years here, the problem is that Senator Pappas and I might think that there's a one-time usage for the city of St. Paul that you know, Senator Pariseau thinks is just without any merit whatsoever, but Senator Pariseau, on the other hand, might have a one-time purpose that, you know, we don't like. So obviously, to some extent, that's in the eye of the legislative beholder.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you were in private enterprise and you had some one-time money, you would use it probably for capital improvements, investments or capital improvements for your business. So there's the ability to buy down debt service. There's the ability to set it aside for next year's bonding bill. There's ways to, you know, to maneuver to spend it one time and have it truly be an investment in the future. I don't envy you your task this year because everybody with this rhetoric of $2.2 billion surplus, there's a lot of people, a lot of the interest groups want you to spend it on their program forever, and you don't have it forever. I mean, it's like this: all the stars lined up such that this. The data is perfect. You've got $1 billion as of June 30th, and after that, you've got no extra money. That's what the data shows, is that your budget is essentially balanced with the governor's proposal for the following 2 years, so you can take, you can put back in, you can add to, subtract from, but essentially you've got that balanced budget in the out year to look at.
Other questions for Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pariseau.
As I think about some of the needs that we have heard from people, and between education requirements, requests, let's say, health reform requests, and that model that says government should provide all these things, and anything else that we have to do, and then give tax relief at the same time, I think it's an end, and the economic development, the economic investments that you suggest, which I think makes sense, there are. Everything could be endless. Everything could be forever. We could say it's one time, but one time runs out, and pretty soon they're back for another one time, or for endless. And I think that every group that has interests figure once the government kicks in and takes responsibility for the funding of their threshold, that we have to be there forever. And I think that doing that, and even when we started it, it was the beginning of the downfall of government being the only provider of everything, from waste handling. Education. How about rides to church on Sunday? I mean, what's not in there anymore? So that slide is, I think, a scary one when we start providing everything to people who, if you let their money stay in their pocket, could do it very well themselves.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you, Senator,
it's an opinion,
Pariseau.
Of course. You know, there's no need to respond.
You clearly have choices. You can eliminate the programs you think aren't necessary and add to those programs that you think are. The dilemma that you know that you face is that you got to balance it. And essentially you have no new money other than this one-time money to do the balancing for the next biennium. This has happened before, but not quite as clearly for the legislature and the governor to see the way it is actually one time and then ongoing.
Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kondrowski, you said that that we're probably weighted too much on the income tax and we should balance a little bit more. How much out of balance are we, do you think, on the income? I don't know what the percentage is that we collect on income versus property and sales, but do you know? Income's probably about half, I would imagine.
Well, let me give you these statistics. This is from 2003.
32.
Our income tax ranks seventh in the country, and these are all on the basis of $1,000 of personal income. So our income tax was seventh highest in the country in 2003. Our sales tax was 34th, and our property tax was 26th. And that gives you a sense of the imbalance so that you'd have to move quite a bit to alter that. There's more recent data, and you need to look at this also as state and local, which suggests that our property tax is actually less than average now in Minnesota, with, again, income tax being very high and sales tax being very low. Again, so the sales and income tax relative rankings have remained the same, but property tax now is less than average.
Mr. Chair, where do you think, I mean, if you could design an ideal system, would it be about equal of those of property sales and income, or where do you perfect balance might fall?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville?
Right.
And I'm not the first one to use this analogy, but we keep using a stool and saying essentially the three legs need to be in balance for you to be able to sit on the stool. That's a bit of an oversimplification. It might be that you want income taxes to raise 40% with sales tax 35% and property taxes 25%. The only point here is that the more you use a volatile source like the income tax, the more you're going to have volatility in the system, which is essentially what we have.
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand the point, and I think I agree with it. You said you have some literature. Would it be hard for you to submit that to Senator
Cohen? No, I'd be happy to.
So that I'd be interested in seeing some of this and compare us with other states and try to figure out where this balance ought to be.
Yeah, great.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on Senator Neville's questions and your comments, I think we need to go back to the progressivity issue as well, because you commented on that before in relation to the sales tax, but even though we're more income tax heavy in Minnesota, I think that's been one reason why we also have had a more progressive tax than most states. And so if you try to catch up with everyone else on the sales tax, most of them do not do that in a progressive way. And so I just, volatility is an important issue, but progressivity is also, and so they need to be balanced. So I guess you have a six-legged or four-legged stool. I don't know how many legs.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I did make the specific caveat that I'm not proposing simply a substitution of sales taxes for income taxes. There has to be a mechanism that recognizes that for lower-income people, lower-middle-income people, that would be a substantial burden, lowering the income tax and increasing the sales tax. But through your income tax, you do have the ability to offset some of that problem as a deduction on your income tax, which would tend to keep the progressivity. I haven't done any work on actually looking at the details of that and exactly how you'd do it. But conceptually, I think there are ways that you can do it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd be interested to know how Minnesota, you gave the rankings on the three areas, but I'd like to know how we rank in the area of a progressive tax in general compared to other states. I know we've been high.
Yes.
And I think our income tax has gotten sharply less progressive in recent years, so I don't know how much that's changed. At least that's my perception. That would be useful information.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I'm not familiar with the notion that our income tax has gotten less progressive.
Well,
lowered our income tax. but I'm not sure it's less progressive.
The whole tax, Mr. Chairman, well, Mr. Chair, maybe the whole tax system is not progressive.
That could be because we lowered the income tax portion. But we still have a fairly progressive tax system. It's very hard to measure them across the country, state by state. But again, we have more problem with recessions than most states do.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Parasol.
I don't know if Mr. Kudrowski would have an opinion on this or any knowledge specifically, but I'm just looking at the county of Dakota right now. And not only did everybody's evaluations, you know, jack up, we know the taxes are going to follow that. Besides that, it happened a few times. And how about the referendums that school districts conduct at any time of the year, any time of any year, instead of in the general election time, and call it at their will, based on whatever they want to have? And what about the oversight for that in the whole tax picture of everything going on? I mean, that's something that isn't overseen by the state. The state doesn't give permission, doesn't have regulations on it, doesn't have any way of controlling the taxes that everyone else has to pay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any insight on that? Because I'm just looking at, never mind the wheelage tax that they've already done, and then they're going to pick up some gas tax increase, sales tax increase, and they're saying they just do it willy-nilly.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Parasol, I'm really not capable of responding specifically to school referendums.
Part of the big package.
I do have a bias after working 17 years in the private sector, and that's that I think that the legislature and the governor try to control too much of what happens in local government. The mandates coming from this building, the attempts to control levy limits, to control other things, I think are problematic. One of the lessons I learned at Wells Fargo was that we tried to make decisions as close as we could to the customer because those people really understood best the problems. So my bias is that I think local government has a really good understanding of what their citizens want, and I think it's hard for legislators and governors to understand and try to then generalize with a general law for all those jurisdictions in the state of Minnesota. So I tend to be one that is less likely to want to limit what local government can do. But clearly they're a part of our total state local tax system.
There are so many entities, Mr. Chairman, who have taxing power now, and I think that we forget how many are out of the hands of any kind of oversight.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Parasol, Minnesota is unusual in that it gives very little taxing jurisdiction to local government. Many states give sales tax authority to cities. Some states give income tax authority to cities. Minnesota is unusual in that it hasn't given other tax sources other than for a specific purpose, i.e. the XL Energy Center or the Minneapolis Auditorium that uses sales tax receipts. Minnesota doesn't give local government authority for other taxes, and we're different in that regard. If you just look at the charts, that gap is very noticeable in Minnesota versus the average of the states across the country.
Further questions for Mr. Kudrowski? Okay, well, thank you very much for being here.
Well,
appreciate it.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, the next on the agenda is Dr. Tom Stinson. And I think as members know, Dr. Stinson is the state's economist and has served in that capacity for a number of years. And I think it goes without saying, but I'll say it, that with all the discussions we've had and the volatility of those discussions over the last several years as to what we should spend, not spend, what we should do with the budget, nobody's ever questioned the work of Dr. Stinson relative to the promulgation of the forecast. We're always dealing with the same set of numbers, and I don't think anybody has, as best I know, unless Dr. Stinson, you can correct me, that anybody has challenged those numbers and called into question the work of Dr. Stinson and his staff in doing so. So it's always very useful to get a more detailed perspective on the Minnesota economy. We had a a general perspective offered to us in terms of world, national, state by Mr. Laufenberg at the start of the meeting, but to get your detailed outlook on where we're going with the forecast.
Mr. Chairman, it's a pleasure to be here this morning. I thought that I'd start off by saying the person that actually hired me is sitting right there. And so that's the amount of time I've been there. I'm not sure what Dan Laufenberg told you this morning, how much detail he went into about the national economy or the national economic outlook. I talked to Dan just real briefly out in the hall. He told me, he told you, the world was going to come to an end sometime in 2009, but until that you were okay. I'm not sure the world comes to an end in 2009, but we're certainly a little bit concerned. There's a handout that you have, which looks like that. Yeah, okay. And I'm going to kind of go through that just real quickly to give you a little bit of background on the forecast that we issued in November, and then talk a little bit about the overall outlook for the Minnesota economy going on out. On the second page of that handout is what former Commissioner Kodrowski was talking about, and that is a really vivid description of what the challenge from this forecast is. There's $913 million worth of additional revenue for the 2006-2007 biennium, about 2.9% change in the revenue outlook, but then for 2008-2009, there's only an additional $297 million, or 0.9%. What happened in this forecast really was that the outlook for 2008-2009 didn't change very much, and when the economic outlook doesn't change very much, there's not much that happens to revenues either. If you turn to the next page, you can see where the changes in revenue came. And this is instructive because it indicates that there are two forces that affect revenues for the state. One is the economy, and the economy certainly contributed some, but then also in this forecast there were changes, really large changes, for technical reasons. And I want to talk about those real quickly. On the income tax, we added $503 million in 2006-2007, 3.7%. The forecast went up. It was due almost entirely to stronger than anticipated tax liability growth for tax year 2005. That the refunds that were paid out from April through June and the final payments that were made prior to that were higher than were expected, and that added to the base level for the liability, and that was then carried on forward. The sales tax is actually down slightly. Now it's down $92 million in 2006-2007 and $154 million, 1.6% in 2008-2009. Part of that's due to weaker sales tax growth than we had forecast, but also part of it's due to a change in the perception of how much money we're going to get from compliance with the streamlined sales tax procedures. We took $36 million out of 2006-2007 because that money just doesn't seem to be showing up, and then $99 million out of 2008-2009. On the corporate, that's where we had the big percentage increases, 18% in 2006-2007 and 17.5% in 2008-2009. Part of it's due to very, very strong corporate profits, and I'll talk about that as a concern going on out into the future a little bit. And ties back into former Commissioner Kudrowski's concern about the volatility of the tax system, the corporate profits and the corporate income tax is the most volatile part of Minnesota's tax system, and it's getting to be a larger percentage at this point, and so that adds to the overall volatility of the system. Again, we had very strong corporate profits, but also there's a change in the Department of Revenue's perception of how much the Hutchinson technology decision is going to cost us. We added $103 million in 2006-2007 because of a reduction in the estimate of the cost of the Hutchinson technology decision, and we added $64 million in 2008-09. Finally, there's the motor vehicle sales tax projection, and that was reduced by $17 million, 3.4% in 2006-2007, and then by $206 million, or 40%, in 2008-2009. The large decline in 2008-2009 is due to the passage of or approval of the constitutional amendment phasing in the dedication of the motor vehicle sales tax to the Highway User Trust Fund. Without the constitutional amendment, the motor vehicle sales tax would have declined by about $50 million, though, so there still wouldn't have been as much money.
And Dr. Stinson, just relative to that, the governor has proposed legislating the parallel with the leased car exemptions. So would that add to that 0809 figure at whatever point it kicks in?
That would decrease if that is passed. That will decrease the revenue coming to the general fund. So that's a negative on the fund statement. Now that won't be part of the forecast. The forecast is current law, and then the next time that we do the forecast, we'll be looking at what the new current law is, and so you won't see that in the forecast. That'll be part of the fund statement report.
But would it be reflected if we pass that during this year's legislative session? Would that be reflected in the forecast you put out in November then?
The forecast in November will incorporate any law changes that are passed in the current session. But it won't reduce, it won't show a decline in the forecast because the forecast in November will be from end of session estimates as opposed to from the February forecast. So the baseline or the bottom line number will be reset after the legislative session is over.
Okay, thanks.
The economy really hasn't changed very much, and it didn't change very much between last February and November. It really hasn't, the outlook hasn't changed very much to this point between November and January, although we expect that Global Insight's going to be a little bit more optimistic in their February forecast. That'll add a little bit of money probably to the forecast, other things equal, but of course, other things won't be equal, and so at this point, until we do the forecast, we just don't know where we're going to be on the outlook. There's a page that maybe is two pages in. It says four items of concern for the U.S. economy. The big items of concern are housing, interest rates, inflation, and energy. Starting with the energy, you know, that's the one that we see every day as we drive by the gas station and say, oh, gasoline prices are up 19 cents or, oh, they're down 6 cents or whatever. Thus far, it's been a plus for the economy, but the lower energy prices are not expected to continue, and the forecast is really based on $60-plus dollar a barrel oil throughout the entire forecast horizon. Inflation and interest rates are tied. The Fed's concerned about inflation. That's their job. Their goal is probably, Dan Laufenberg told you, is to try and keep core inflation down below 2%, and Dan is questioning whether they're really going to be successful in doing that. The way they do that, of course, is by raising interest rates and trying to slow the economy, and it's a difficult job because you have to be looking 6 to 9 months ahead or maybe even more trying to figure out what it's going to happen in the economy so that you can time your action. That's really the big issue, and I think probably Dan told you that his concern is that it gets slightly out of hand and the Fed has to raise interest rates in late 2008 or early 2009 and bring on a recession. The biggest concern right now, and it's a big concern, maybe a bigger concern in Minnesota than it is nationally, if that makes sense, is housing. We're in a very difficult situation for the housing sector. U.S. Housing starts are down almost 30%. Often things go on in the national economy, and we say this is a bi-coastal phenomenon. It's not going to affect Minnesota. It turns out that the situation's worse, actually, in Minnesota than nationally. If you look at the next graph, it shows you what's happened to housing permits in Minnesota. On a seasonally adjusted basis, the first quarter of 2006, we were averaging about 2,500 housing permits issued per month. By the end of the year, by November, on a seasonally adjusted basis, we were at 1,500 or 1,400. So we're down more than 40% over that time, which is more than the U.S. average. And the question really is whether the forecast that we have, which you can see the lighter colored bars starting to go up and going up to 1,750 per month, whether that is too optimistic or not, and we'll be finding that out over the next few months. Generally, our expectation is that housing is going to be extremely weak in Minnesota for all of 2007, and then it will hopefully improve some in 2008. Now, that's a problem. It's a problem for the people that work in the construction industry, and we have the loss of 9,000 jobs occurring in the construction industry, but it's also a problem for the state's lumber and wood products industry. There we had, in the November forecast, a loss of 2,000 jobs. Unfortunately, the forecast wasn't more than a few days old before we had both the Ainsworth shutdown, which was more than 500 jobs, and the Anderson Windows layoffs, which is approximately 500 jobs, which said that we'd used up 1,000 of our 2,000 layoffs that we had in the forecast just in the first few weeks after the forecast. So this is something that we're very concerned about. And then we're also concerned about the effect that lower housing prices, decline in housing prices, something that hasn't occurred since the Great Depression, would have on consumer spending. And, of course, that's an area where everybody hopes that the situation doesn't turn out to be as bad as possible, but it's something where we don't really have any data so that we haven't seen a decline in housing prices over a year for the U.S. economy to know what was going to happen. Turning to the next page, here's a concern that we have, again, with respect to the volatility of the corporate income tax. This picture shows you what happens if you plot corporate profits in the S&P 500 on the same axis. And if you look at the dark line, that's corporate profits. If you look at the light-colored line, that's the stock market, S&P 500. And you can see that they track each other pretty closely, that the stock market reflects the level of corporate profits, except for a period between 96, 97, and 2001, which shows that the stock market really surged way above corporate profits. This is maybe the best picture of irrational exuberance that you might see. Now what you see is a divergence in the other way, corporate profits way above the stock market. And there are really two ways of looking at this. One is that now is a really, really, really good time to invest in the stock market because it's going to go up and track corporate profits, or now is a really precarious time to base your tax revenues on a corporate income tax so that it could come down and come down relatively quickly. The next page shows another discouraging factor about what's happened to corporate profits. Currently, they're at almost an all-time high as a percentage of gross domestic product. Only in the fourth quarter of 1950, just at the start of the Korean War, were corporate profits as high a percentage of gross domestic product as they are now. That makes revenue forecasters a little bit concerned because what we know is that these numbers can all be revised, and going on out into the future, you could certainly see a drop very quickly. And so we've tried to bring them down, the forecast down very quickly, but clearly we may not have done this sufficiently quickly. A second concern that we have is on the next page, and this is a kind of a complicated question, and it gets at the longer-term economic outlook and longer-term concerns that people have about the stability and the sustainability of spending in this state. Mr. Chairman, I know you were in the legislature in the Senate in 1985-86.
Wasn't in the Senate, but...
Yeah. You probably remember the fact that that was a really difficult time for a lot of states, California, New York, Massachusetts in particular, the big states, because capital gains revenue didn't show up the way that they thought it was going to. And California had a $5 billion shortfall on a $40 billion budget at that time. Because of capital gains. And if you look at the next slide, what you see is what happened when there was a change in the capital gains rate in the Tax Reform Act of 1986. That what happened, obviously, was that people said, wait a minute, if it's going to be more expensive for me to, if the tax is going to be higher if I sell my stock in February next year, rather than selling it now, I'm going to sell it now. And so there was a huge surge in sales of capital assets in 86. And then when the tax rate went up, all that had been borrowed from the future. And so there was a huge drop off in the second year. Well, if you turn to the next page, you can see that we're going to have the same kind of a situation in 2010 and 2011 when the president's tax cuts expire under current law, that the capital gains rate is going to go from 15% to 20%. The federal tax capital gains rate is going to go from 15% to 20%. And that's going to create another huge surge, and you can see the magnitude of the surge now compared to that little tiny blip that occurred in 85 on this next chart. And that huge surge is going to pump money into fiscal year 2011, but then the snapback is going to affect 2012. So looking on out, question of structural balance, the revenue side of fiscal year 2011 is actually distorted compared to what's going to occur in 2012. Now, we don't do a forecast for 2012 at this point, but I can tell you that there's going to be a substantial drop off in capital gains revenues, a drop off maybe a swing of $800 million or something along the, on that order between 2000, fiscal year 2011 and fiscal year 2012. That's something that you want to keep in the back of your mind as you go on out thinking about structural balance for the 2010-2011 biennium. Final thing, let me just kind of review for you what we told the Council of Economic Advisors last Friday. And what we told the council was that at this point revenues are close to what we forecast in November and December, that actually total receipts are up $57 million, but almost all of that comes from corporate miscellaneous revenues, which are payments that accompanied tax forms or payments for prior tax years, so that the current part of revenues, the expectations as to how the economy, that give us some expectation as to how the economy is doing, that really hasn't changed. The individual income tax receipts are down just very slightly, about $5 million, and sales tax receipts are down, again, very slightly, about $7 million. The sales tax receipts don't reflect at this point December Christmas sales, however, though, so that's a big surge that could go either way, and the income tax receipts don't reflect fourth quarter estimated tax payments, which could go either positive or negative, although at this point it looks like they're not going to be as high as we thought. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my overview, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Dr. Stinson, obviously you can't indicate what the forecast, you haven't finished the forecast, I assume, for the end of February. Both Mr. Laufenberg and Mr. Krodowski talked about the continued volatility of Minnesota's revenues over the number of years, whether it be because of economic factors and oncoming, just the cycle, the economic cycle of recession and non-recession, or whether it be the volatility of Minnesota's tax revenue streams. Would you have any disagreement with them that this kind of boom or bust kind of environment we've been in the last number of years is going to continue?
Mr. Chairman, no, I would not. I actually wrote a piece, Jeremy Prehm and I wrote a piece for the Minnesota Journal or whatever it is that the Citizens League puts out a couple or 3 years ago, where we documented the fact that much of Minnesota's tax base is more volatile than GDP, that GDP goes up and GDP goes down, but capital gains, corporate profits, spending on consumer durables, spending on motor vehicles, all go up faster than GDP goes up when GDP goes up, and go down more when GDP goes down than GDP does. Historically, wages have been the thing that reduced the volatility. Wages were more stable than GDP, and the growth rate in wages didn't move around as much as GDP. But with the introduction of and more emphasis on performance-based compensation, bonuses, and options, that's made wages go up and down more than GDP as well. And so all of the components of the tax base actually go up and down more rapidly than GDP does. Now, there are things that you can do to help ameliorate this problem, and Commissioner Kudrowski talked about one of them, which is broadening the sales tax base and offsetting that with a refundable credit. There are other things that we can do that are revenue neutral. we have a capital gains, which is clearly the most volatile part of our tax system. Capital gains go up some years 40%, and then the next year they'll go down 20%. So, you know, those are huge swings. For capital gains, we could change our tax policy. So instead of taxing all of capital gains, we're only taxing 50% or 60% or whatever the appropriate percentage is. And that reduces some of that. Then we could make up the tax revenue lost by raising the tax on the highest income individuals. And for the highest income individuals, it would probably, for on average, be a wash. You know, they pay less on their capital gains, pay more on their overall rate, and so it wouldn't be much different. We could reduce the emphasis on the corporate income tax by moving to increase the corporate tax, the property tax on commercial and industrial property. That would be something that we could do in a revenue-neutral manner. It wouldn't be perfectly neutral across all firms or anything like that, but it would reduce the volatility of the system somewhat. So there are a lot of opportunities, and it seems to me that, and Commissioner Kudrowski, or former Commissioner Kudrowski, also pointed out this whole issue about taxing the baby boom in retirement and what's going to happen there. Again, Jeremy Prame and I actually have some examples of how people's tax liabilities would change over time in there. These are all things that we need to be thinking about. They're not things that can be done. I think that it's going to require some concerted public policy education and public policy discussion, something along the lines of tax study commission like the Latimer Commission and the one in the 1950s that was done by the state. It's about time that we begin to look at these kinds of things in a concerted manner.
You know, what I'm taking away from this discussion, and it's not as if we haven't heard a lot of this before, but I think the combination of the three of you this morning, what I'm taking away from it is that at least insofar as a legislature is concerned, this legislature, we can't affect the world economy. We have nothing to say about that. We can't affect the private market insofar as wages are concerned. We're not going to outlaw bonuses or various kinds of alternative payments within the market. I mean, we could try to do that, but you know, I'm not sure we can do that legally, but we're not going to do that. The question of a structural budget insofar as reserves are concerned is, by definition, a temporary fix. So what it comes back to is, as a finance committee, if we want to continue to spend money and not be in the boom or bust cycle, what I'm taking away from this conversation is there's no choice but to diversify the sales tax. And that's, at least for a legislature, the only answer. Otherwise, we continue the boom or bust.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's the only choice. I mean, there are things you can do with the income tax. There are things you can do with the corporate income tax. You can change the relationship between the income tax and the sales tax and the property tax. I mean, there are a lot of decisions, a lot of levers that can be pulled to adjust the tax system. And I'm not sure that your choices are restricted solely spreading or changing the sales tax. Now, that's certainly a major consideration, but there are other things that can be done as well, and probably there are other things that probably should be done.
Thanks. Sir Neville.
Mr. Chair, maybe I should ask Mr. Kudrowski this question, but I'll ask you. He made a comment about when the baby boomers hit retirement age and that the income will drop significantly, but I mean, aren't we the first generation that's really going to be using all these IRAs, 401ks, all this deferred income that we're going to have to start drawing out? And that's going to have significant, in addition to Social Security, which isn't taxable for a lot of people, aren't we going to have more income than past And won't that at least offset that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman.
We're in retirement?
Senator Neville, sure we're going to have more income, but we're going to have less. Most people are not going to retire on more income than they're earning before they retire.
I might.
Well,
I make practically nothing right now. We need a salary increase. Okay, I shouldn't be too glib here.
No, but Jeremy Prame and I did some stuff where we assumed that people would retire on 70% of their prior income, which is the financial planner's goal, is for you to retire on 70% of your prior income. And for a couple that was retiring, they'd been making $35,000 a year, admittedly a lower income household. They'd been paying, if I remember right, $2,000 in combined income tax and sales tax at that. And then they turn 65 and retire, and they pay less than $500. So their income goes down by 30%, but their tax liability, the combined amount of taxes they pay, goes down by 75%. For another household, this was a household that was making $65,000, retired, and they're making $45,000 in retirement. Their tax bill went down by 40% or 50%, and I can't quite remember the amounts, but it's like $6,000 to $3,000 or something along that line. And it's like former Commissioner Kudrowski said, once you retire, a lot of that money that you're living off of is money that you contributed in there, so that if it's a bank account and you're drawing out your bank account, it's only the interest that's being taxed. The underlying asset value isn't, to the extent that it's a 401k or 403b or some other tax-deferred account. Of course, obviously, it's all there. But there's also special treatment of Social Security. There's also special treatment of retirement income, and there are maybe more special treatment of retirement income in there. It's something that we need to consider as to whether we're going to provide that subsidy or not. There are special provisions in the tax law that reduce the liability for senior citizens in various ways. So, it's not to say that there's anything wrong with this, but the demographics are going to catch up with us very soon, and the first of the baby boomers probably are already retiring, but they're going to be 65 in 2011, and so that's something we just need to be thinking about.
And it's the double whammy, because it's less revenues as the baby boomers, but it's also all the entitlements and the expense side that maybe is more significant than the loss on the revenue side.
Senator Neville, you're absolutely right. I'll tell you a story. Story is, I talked to the Minnesota Business Partnership more than a year ago about this, and one of the members of the business partnership said, I just don't think this is a problem. Said, why would anybody in their right mind, after they're retired, stay in Minnesota? They're going to move to another state anyway, and so we don't have a problem. And Mr. Hubbard from KSTP, who makes his living really on demographics, didn't allow me to answer the question. He said, turn around, he told this guy, he said, that just goes to show you don't understand the demographics. You don't understand what's going on in the state. He said, what goes on in the state is that people do move out of the state after they retire, but then at age 70 or 68, when they begin to have health problems, they come back here for access to health care and because their support network is here. And so it's worse than what you're describing, actually, that we lose them in their higher income retirement years and then get them back at the point where they have more entitlements, more demand on entitlements.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pearsall.
I'd just like to ask Mr. Stinson, on the two examples that you gave about the reduction of taxes, were property taxes included in that example, or was that just state taxes? to the other kinds of state taxes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Paraso, no, that's just state income tax and state sales tax. Now, you're the political expert, not me, but I don't think that it's going to be a real easy thing for you to run on saying that you're going to tax senior citizens out of your homes.
No, that's right. That's right.
So that just emphasizes the problem.
And it's the same time when their health costs increase or their health care needs increase. And so getting them out of their home at that point is not a good thing to do.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stinson, I think one of the additional problems that we have is that the new people coming to our state, the increase in our population and our workforce, really are at very low incomes. The growth of the number of people in our state that are at 100% of poverty or less is astounding. And, you know, when people retire at age 65, it doesn't automatically mean that they're eligible for any kind of entitlement. But when people are coming into this state working and earning less than 100% of poverty, they are entitled to things in this state. And I think that that is something that we should be equally concerned about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that's certainly right. And one would expect that people migrating to the state would start off maybe at a slight disadvantage to people that had already moved to the state. But the real challenge, or had already been in the state in terms of their earnings and things like that, just because they're new to the job, they don't have those job-specific skills and things. The real challenge is making sure that we allow these people the opportunity to succeed and to get above the poverty level. And so this raises a whole set of questions about training and training needs for people coming to the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Berlin.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stinson, over the last 4 years, we haven't seen much change in this income level. So, you know, the idea that, you know, it's just because they haven't been here that long, you know, they're significantly disadvantaged over people that are starting out in Minnesota without a college education in terms of the income that they earn, and we aren't seeing much improvement in it over time.
Okay. Further questions, comments for Dr. Stinson? Well, thank you very much for being here. I think the combination of, obviously, Dr. Stinson, it's always we always learn a lot when you're here, but I think the combination this morning has been particularly useful, so I appreciate everybody being here. And then we'll head back to our newly recommended Commissioner Hansen and Mr. Showalter for a discussion on the budget. Obviously, the divisions and the way we've restructured the Finance Committee, I think everybody, with the exception of Senator Metzen, who's here as President of the Senate, is a division chair. At least in the majority. So obviously we're not looking for the details of each division, but the highlights and the strategy and direction that the governor is presenting us or suggesting to us through his budget. So Commissioner Hansen, Mr. Showalter.
We handed out the black set of slides that you can follow along, Mr. Chairman. It's right there. On the first slide, you will see budget highlights, and I just wanted to point out a few things. The proposed general fund spending for 2008-2009 is $34.4 billion. And there are, as is always the case with numbers, a couple of different ways to look at it. One way is to keep in mind that the November forecast had grew state spending by $1 billion, which is about 3.2%. And we have a chart in here later on that shows where that growth occurred. But as you can probably guess, it was primarily Health and Human Services forecast growth. The overall number, when you factor in the November forecast growth, one of the numbers you see the governor use is $2.9 billion, or a 9.3% over 2 years. And that is a 9.3% 08-09 spending growth over 06-07 base. In other words, that doesn't, you have to factor in inflation into that number over a two-year period. You see, that's the next item on the list. The consumer price index for 2008-2009 is 4.2%. And as we talked about inflation a little earlier in the hearing, there are different measures of inflation. There is the CPI, which is a lower measure. There's the state and local price deflator, which there's a discussion on it in the November forecast, and I'm sure there'll be another one in the February forecast. It's generally a higher measure. So as you budget, it's almost a level of risk going forward. We left a $1.1 billion deficit structural balance for 2010-2011, which exceeds CPI slightly. Another way of looking, you see the overall picture on the second slide that's titled General Fund Balance Sheet. You see that we begin the 08-09 biennium with $2.1 billion. That represents the reserve, the cash flow, and the surplus revenues we carry forward from 06-07. The revenues we collect for 2008-2009 is $33.5 billion minus the governor's initiatives, and you get a total of $33.375 billion.
You know, Commissioner Hanson, we were willing to recommend your confirmation. That was not based apparently upon spelling ability, though.
Initiate.
The governor's initiates? Or what is that?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Is it on this slide?
No, general fund balance sheet.
This is why we need more money on the formula in K-12.
More money for rural schools that I attended in Northern Minnesota.
Technology expenditure, right?
Okay. I think that was Matt that pointed that out. I saw him later.
I pointed out to him.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get that corrected. Thank you. The forecast spending is almost $32.5 billion. You see our total initiatives at 1.9, and you get the 34.4 that I referenced on the first slide. And the difference you see between the spending and the revenues is roughly the one-time number. And then we left a $10 million balance on the bottom line. The next slide, you see the general fund spending just graphic kind of laid out a little differently. You see it was 31.5 in 06-07 and 34.4. You see the $2.9 billion and the $9.3. And again, want to emphasize that's over a two-year period. And if you remember from the first slide, the consumer price index or inflation was 4.2%. So all that 9.3 is not all of an increase when you factor in inflation. And then remember, as the members of this committee already know, that we have other funds other than the general fund. It's the Healthcare Access Fund, the Trunk Highway Fund, federal funds, and numerous others. They add up to, for this biennium, $55 billion. It's a $4.3 billion increase for about 8.6%. On the next slide, the general fund budget, you see the governor's recommendations graphically portrayed on a pie chart. It's $34 billion. You see that the bulk of our money and the decisions that drive everything else are K-12, higher ed, property tax aids and credits, and health and human services. The bottom chart, $55 billion, represents all of the general, federal, and special revenue funds. The next chart I referenced a little earlier, it's the forecast spending. It grows $1 billion before any decisions are made, and there's a couple of points worth noting. You see that the Health and Human Services number grew by $1.1 billion. That's a 13.5% increase. Mr. Chairman, the other interesting note, you see the all other, which decreases 15.6%. That represents a decrease in spending in 08-09 of paying off shifts that we paid off in 06-07. So since we're not spending, we're not buying off the shifts. We shows up as a negative number on this chart.
And I take the small increase in public safety reflects a stabilization of incarceration rates,
yes.
Sex offender commitments,
yes, it
whatever
does.
Else might be coming into the criminal system.
Yes, it does.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Neville.
Mr. Hansen, what's the 1.8% in K-12, 225? If this is before any decisions are made and we don't include inflation, I thought enrollment is kind of flat in K-12. I take it that number, that's a doesn't
it's a biennial number.
It doesn't include inflation either, does it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I was informed it represents a formula increase, that there was increased funding levels in 06-07 as that annualizes and goes into 08-09. The biennial change between those two numbers is represented here in the growth figure that you're seeing. There's small enrollment changes that were reflected in the forecast, but that's not really what's driving this growth figure.
I got you.
Commissioner.
The bottom chart, Governor's Plan, it's the whole 2.9 that represents the forecast changes from November, as well as the $1 billion you're carrying forward from 06-07 and the $1 billion that's there in 08-09. You see the, it shows up, I don't know if it shows up as well on the, yes, it actually shows up fairly well on your slides. The gray represents the forecast growth. The black represents the recommendations in the governor's budget. You see the 15.6% for Health and Human Services, 16% for higher ed, and 7.7% for K-12 and the other initiatives. The budget highlight slide depicts how much new spending in millions that the governor's recommending. You see the K-12 number at $714 million and higher ed at $414 for our total new spending in K-12 and higher ed of $1.1 billion. Our tax relief number is $281 million. Our health care number, $274, represents also health care access spending. And you see the rest of the numbers on there. The other thing I want to note, I know there was some discussion on one-time money earlier. The technology investments, the $213 million, represents the aggregate number across all of our agencies. We put, for these purposes, we added it all up, and they will be included in individual bills, but we also have prepared for a discussion on everything in aggregate. Then finally, the governor had outlined in his State of the State, as well as his budget address, themes of rewarding performance, Q-Comp, Q-Care, and the nursing facility performance pay have been initiatives before that we have highlighted again, and then our successful schools initiative and the U of M MinSCU performance bonus. Mr. Showalter is going to walk through briefly some of the details in each of the areas.
Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Senators, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm the State Budget Director. I'm going to start with the next slide that's titled K-12 Education World-Class Students. With this slide, as with some of the other ones, these include some of the announcements that the governor made even before the budget release. They are detailed more explicitly in the biennial budget documents, as well as some of the executive summary materials that we provided on the 22nd. In this instance, the governor is looking at the question of successful schools and successful students in Minnesota already performing well and trying to understand and trying to think about how do we go continue that success into the future. In particular, he's looking at high school performance and trying to find ways to expand the amount of rigorous coursework that's available in high schools and find ways so that those students are moving from high schools into the workforce, into technical colleges, into colleges and universities that are prepared and appropriate for whatever they may be looking for. The initiatives are listed here as per your instructions. I'm not going to go into details on each one of these. If you have questions about any of them or as a package, we can certainly do that.
I just want to ask a question and recognize that I think Senator Langseth is going to be here at 11 o'clock, but and I'm a member this year of Senator Pappas's division, so I'll have a chance to ask some of that. But yeah, I appreciate the governor's interest in some performance standards. Is there anything comparable in other states in terms of what the governor's proposed with higher education? Because it seems to me that there's a significant difference between K-12 and the imposition of standards versus higher education, just as something very simple. If a commonplace performance standard with K-12 is how many kids graduate from high school within a school district, you know, there's a difference in terms of higher education graduation. We've never viewed the 4 years, maybe other than when I was a kid and we had the draft or something. People might go through school in 5 years, 6 years, 3 years. Is there anything else comparable in terms of performance standards at a higher education level?
Mr. Chair, I'm only aware of at least a couple of states. Perhaps we can get more information, but that there are some states that have performance incentives involved in their higher education system. I think Pennsylvania comes to mind as one state that's been going down that road for a number of years. I'm not sure of other states that necessarily have chosen the path that's being proposed here, but that it is something that has been done at least in a couple of other states. I'm not sure about the K-12 system. Certainly, I think the generic question is how and where to use performance standards and what incentives that you want to have in those. We had that discussion 2 years ago when presenting the budget, and I think it's an ongoing discussion of how is best to incent performance, how to measure it, and how to set what the expectations are for whether it's K-12, higher education, state government, or anyone else. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
There probably are measurable benchmarks in higher ed. You know, across the country, people are looking at it. We are developing an accountability system, and our division is going to be looking at that system and deciding if we agree with it or not. I would say that this might be a little premature because we haven't quite done that yet.
Mr. Chairman,
the graduation rate is usually pegged at 6 years.
The governor and I did have an opportunity to talk to President Brunix from the university in December, and he said there is a they do have a performance measures and as they manage at the U, but there is a body of literature that university presidents and policymakers nationwide have accessed. So it is a topic of discussion nationally.
I was going to get a little bit ahead in terms of the slides, but just because it dovetails with that overall presentation of the governor's strategy. But Mr. Schulter, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, the next slide is related to higher education, and the relationship to the K-12 proposal is that the governor is looking for strategies to make sure that students that are academically prepared in high school then have the financial opportunity and ability to continue on education in other institutions. That includes the Achieve 2 proposal, which is student-based funding to make sure that students that take challenging courses in K-12 system have additional funding that's available for them to continue on in higher education. That's a $92 million initiative. Additional funding is available for the University of Minnesota as well as the State Colleges and Universities, MINSCU. For U of M, the total funding is $115 million plus an additional $38 million for the UMayo partnership, total of $153 million. For MINSCU, it's $123 million. The next slide is related to the energy proposals. The governor has made a number of different proposals that are listed here, also announced prior to the budget release, essentially focusing on the continuum of development of alternative energies from basic research to commercialization of existing ideas to continuing to strengthen the industry that's already in place. Total energy package of $40 million. In healthcare reform, the next slide is looking at a number of different strategies, primarily looking at the market and trying to identify ways to make sure that existing funds can continue to be used more effectively, and particularly looking at ways to use the insurance market and access to that better.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hansen, or Mr. Showalter. I just have to take issue with the continual use of language in terms of lowering premiums. Your plan does not lower premiums. Your plan does not lower health care spending. Your plan diverts money from the tax system to increase the amount of money available to spend on health care. I hardly think that could be characterized as lowering health care spending and thereby lowering premiums.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I may, point well taken as terms of the Healthy Connections does ensure that individuals can access federal tax credits basically to help pay for their health insurance. I believe the lower premiums is referring to the children who previously were priced at a level similar to adults. The proposal makes sure that those children in Minnesota care are priced at a, it is basically a different rate, which is a lower rate than what is previously in law.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter, we both agree that we should have lower premiums in Minnesota care. We think you haven't gone far enough.
Mr. Chair, members, continuing on to the next slide, it relates to providing tax relief. A total package of $281 million of all different types of nature. They include some elements for property tax relief as well as income tax relief. And some of these items have also been even in front of the Senate and the House already and have come before the governor.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Berlin.
Mr. Chairman, I had another question on the health care page, which is how was the decision made to give a 1.5% increase for long-term care providers that serve our clients in the state of Minnesota, but for long-term care providers that work directly for the state of Minnesota to give a 3.25% increase each year of the biennium?
Well, that's a good point, Senator. The state of Minnesota employees, how we talked about it, one was in the context of do we want to recognize that state employment costs go forward? So it was, and there are some direct costs, contract negotiations. So we did that with state-operated services and under in that guise. And the long-term care, the 2% we provided, 1.5 guaranteed, and the half percent was done in the context of looking at our health and human services budget and what we thought we could afford. I think we can talk more. I think that's a good point, and we can work more on that with you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
On to another principle that's in the governor's budget, pay for performance for long-term care providers in the private sector. There is no pay for performance for nursing facilities that are in the public sector. And I might add that one of the largest expenditures we make in Minnesota, the Minneapolis Veterans Nursing Home, certainly could use some improvement.
Yes, it could.
Have you ever thought of applying pay for performance to your own state agencies?
Yes, and I think that's something we can work on together.
Well, I might just give you a few examples of places you could start looking.
Okay.
How about when the state law says that a person who wants to enroll in Minnesota Care should have their application processed within 30 days, and it takes the state over 90 days to do that?
Well, then what happens what would the performance be if we don't?
One might ask the same thing if you're a nursing home in the state of Minnesota and you don't earn the half percent. Not everybody's going to earn it. It's not set up for everybody to earn it. Obviously, you can't promise any wage increases off of that half percent.
No, but you have, we did recognize the percent and a half, 1.5% for each year, or 3% over the whole biennium. And I don't know what the percentage is of people that qualify for the 0.5%, but I think a good number do.
Well, I
would have given more, Senator, but as we looked at the overall budget and the overall package, we had to prioritize. And we did want to provide something to nursing homes and did everything we could within our overall recommendations.
Well, I think we have to improve your recommendations in that area.
I suspected you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Scholder or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, continuing on from the providing tax relief slide, the next item is honoring our military heroes. It includes a number of proposals to support veterans as well as those serving in Iraq or returning to Minnesota. That includes some of the GI proposals, GI Bill proposals that were announced. Total package is $75 million.
And Mr. Scholder, on that, with the proposed GI Bill, and the higher education section that talks about I think of which piece it was, the Achieve, the post-secondary stuff. Is all that money needed now, or is there a ramp-up period? So are those full amounts needed during this biennium, or is this, does that come into play more gradually?
2 years.
Mr. Chair, let me just double check on this. Because
it must be your junior senior.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it's just making sure I didn't misstate something. The item is not ramped up. The uncertainty is just when people will be coming home. And so the proposal is to make sure that the funding is in place for whenever those people return to Minnesota. It is possible that ultimately it will be ramped up, but it is not entirely clear and not necessarily predictable at this point.
I'm not trying to be facetious about this, but they're not coming home.
Well, we do have the group that I think it was March, they were supposed to come home, and they're coming home. So we do have the 2,000 or so that'll be home this summer. But yes, I mean, that'd be, who knows?
Yeah. Thanks. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, the next slide is just several items of note, including increases in funding for state troopers so that additional 40 state troopers are on the roads. Some one-time funding for transportation purposes. In addition, the dedication of the sales tax on leased vehicles that basically dovetails with the MVEST dedication that was already passed by voters in November. Some continued commitment to housing for those who are homeless or special needs, targeted led through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Funding for clean water, as well as funding for pandemic flu activities. The next slide includes items that are related to the economic development, job Z continuation, and other things that are related there. The concluding slide, sort of summarizing the overall strategy that you asked about initially, was to try and put about half of the money that was available following the forecast into education, both K-12 and higher education. It also tries to maintain the human services at current laws, as well as make some modifications in mental health and other areas to increase access to services. Make some targeted, though lower dollar in aggregate, but some significant percentage increases in alternative energy and things like that. As well as trying to have some new items for increasing accountability and performance. The next slide just addresses some other issues that are important to make sure that you're aware of. It includes that there is a bonding package that's related to, mostly related to emergency projects, although there is an additional request, basically a consensus item from last session related to the DEC. There's a technology investments, as the commissioner mentioned, $213 million total, A portion of that is infrastructure for the state. A larger portion is for specific items that you'll be seeing going through in each individual policy committee. There's also a request for carry forward, I think a topic that's germane for this committee because it affects, again, all committees and all agencies, asking for carry forward on operational funds so that there's not a use-or-lose incentive, but that that money is basically set aside for one-time purposes related to technology. The budget in general looks at a 2% compensation adjustment for state employees. Those who are in direct care services, as discussed earlier, are generally at a 3.25% increase, basically our estimate of total compensation increase. Also, key financial indicators include indexing the reserves and increasing the reserves to $700 million even. And then finally, there's a small list of deficiencies at a total of $10 million.
Commissioner?
The slide on the next slide just again depicts the pie chart and where our spending is directed, the $2.2 billion. And then in the next slide, the plan increases the budget reserve to $700 million. We add $43 million to take it to 4% of spending in fiscal year 09. Our goal is to take it to 5% of annual spending, which is, I think, 875. And we take the first $50 million out of future surpluses to do that. And then your next slide, I'll let Jim talk about the GAAP financial statements.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, members, we try to remind you periodically what the GAAP statement looks like. This is an accrual look at the state's spending. And after significant uses of shifts and drawing down of reserves to get ourselves out of the budget deficit, we've been repaying those, replenishing our reserves, and putting ourselves back into a positive situation, which is, I think, a shared interest and certainly something that the rating agencies look at.
And then finally, the last chart is shows you the structural balance in 10 and 11. And you can see it adds up to almost $1.1 billion. And then you see the CPI inflation rate in italics at the bottom of the slide. And then just
so without trying to go over this, excuse me, ad nauseum, if you include inflation within the forecast, you'd show at least understand our definition and the distinctions we've made in terms of what monies are available. If you assume for the sake of argument that you're deducting inflation from the projected balance, that would reflect a different figure then.
Yeah,
you did that on a dollar-for-dollar basis.
Right, you would. Right. You would subtract the 904 and take the 904 and the 175 and subtract the italics, and then that would be I guess you can pull it to the other argument that is when you factor in inflation going forward. We cover inflation, we don't go beyond that.
Yes.
Chairman?
Sir Berglund.
I know we have to leave this room, but I just have one quick comment, and that is that the governor must not have felt that the general fund was producing enough money to meet the spending needs that he wanted in his budget, because he has refinanced $70 million of TANF money in this biennium, and it grows to $90 million in the next biennium. There is no inflationary increase for child care. TANF is supposed to be used for our poorest citizens who are struggling to become self-sufficient and for child care. In addition to that, he refinances some of the general fund with Minnesota Care money. And I just don't want you to believe that you should expect to see those things in the final budget.
And just a second, Senator Berglund's position. Obviously, it's been a strong position of the Senate in the last 4 years that the health care access fund is to be utilized for health care access purposes. And, that's been a source of obviously, there are always going to be differences between administration and legislature, irrespective of party or anything else, but that's been one of the significant differences, and that's obviously not a statement of surprise to anybody here.
No, and I think we expected to have a debate, and that Senator Berglund would say, and you would say what you did. Yeah. So we'll look forward to working with you on that.
I don't know how you...
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
The only disappointing thing is that we seem to have to keep having this debate biennium after biennium after biennium.
Well, maybe if we had performance standards for, you know, commissioners and budget directors, then they'd learn about these things. Commissioner Hansen, anything further that...
Nothing else, unless there's more questions.
Other, I know we're getting to the end of this, but other questions or comments for either Commissioner Hansen or Mr. Showalter? Okay, well, thank you very much for the overview. Appreciate it. Appreciate Dr. Stinson, Mr. Kodrowski, Mr. Laufenberg, who left earlier. And when we meet again, we'll probably start going through all these budgets. So meeting adjourned.